Yeah, no, you still have a fair amount of racial segregation in the society, but there is economic segregation within racial groups. Children from low-income families can do amazing things if given the right opportunity. It's just that we build these invisible walls that keep them from flourishing and being all that they can be.
Welcome to Then What Happened from the Columbus Dispatch. The Cap City is booming with innovative, inspiring, and passionate people with intriguing stories to tell. I'm Amelia Robinson, and I'm here to dive into what makes Columbus and its people fascinating. Hey there, friends. I hope you all have been exceptional. The voice you just heard belongs to Richard Kahlenberg. He and I chatted about affordable housing, a topic on the lips of folks throughout the region, when he was in town for Family Flourish and Columbus Metropolitan Club events. Columbus and its economic segregation and the valiant attempts to combat it come up prominently in Richard's new book, Excluded: How Snob Zoning, Nimbyism, and Class Bias Built the Walls We Don't See. You might learn a couple new words during this episode. The Then What Happened podcast is a project of the Columbus Dispatch and an extension of the conversation section. Like and please, please rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your favorite programs. Now on to my talk with Richard Kahlenberg. So obviously the people who do hurt the most are the people who are economically challenged, right? What have you found in your book, your research, that you think might help Columbus the most?
Well, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about Columbus because you've got the best and the worst here. On the one hand, you know, there are very high levels of exclusionary zoning, and as a result, high levels of economic segregation, among the most economically segregated, second most in the country among big cities.
Second most in the country?
Second most in the country. Columbus is a very economically segregated community. And usually, what goes along with that is racial segregation as well.
Yeah, I know redlining was still a big problem in Columbus, and ramifications of that still go on and on and on. Yeah, how is it different from redlining, or are those policies interwoven?
They are interwoven. I'd say, so redlining is illegal under the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And so we're dealing with kind of the remnants of it, I mean, which are powerful, to be sure. But it's illegal. So it's part of a disgraceful past that has ramifications today. Whereas snob zoning or exclusionary zoning is perfectly legal, and it goes on. It's pervasive today, not in this this distant past that we think of when we think of redlining, when we think of racially restrictive covenants, and yet it can have the same sort of impact today in terms of segregating us.
I guess we should probably back up. Hello, welcome. Just to say that first of all. I'm so excited about the topic of obviously housing is something that's important in the city of Columbus and the people of Columbus. And we want to get some solutions before we get deeper into more people coming here, because the city is always growing substantially. So what exactly though is economic segregation?
Economic segregation means exists when rich people and poor people live apart, when middle-class people live in separate neighborhoods from either of those other two groups. So it used to be in this country that there was a fair degree of economic integration. That is, you had a number of mixed-income communities. Oftentimes, they were racially homogenous, but they were mixed-income. And today, increasingly, you have rich people living one place, poor people living another, and then middle class people in some other communities. And so if you look at measures of racial segregation, economic segregation, racial segregation, because the Fair Housing Act has declined modestly, it's down 30%, needs to go further down. But economic segregation is headed in the wrong direction. It's doubled since 1970. And so people of different economic groups are increasingly living apart.
So it'd be like rich black people living near rich white people, or would it be like rich, or is it still both at the same time? But, or are you seeing that?
Yes. Yeah. No, you still have, a fair amount of racial segregation in the society, but there is economic segregation within racial groups. And so, for example, in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is an almost entirely white community, you have rich whites trying to developing policies to exclude poor whites. In Prince George's County, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., majority black community, you have wealthier black people who are, seeking to ban townhouses and other forms of multifamily housing to exclude mostly poor black people. So it happens within communities as well.
And to the whole notion of poor, too, is interesting mm-hmm. to me, too. A lot of times they talk about affordable housing, and you're like, what is affordable housing? They're talking about like a $250,000 mm-hmm. home. And, that's still not really affordable if you're not making a salary for it, right?
That's right. That's right. And yeah, the affordability crisis it goes far beyond just our poorest citizens. And that's part of why we're seeing some political action finally, is that people across, not wealthy people, but most people in America are worried about housing costs. And that is also important for getting some political change in the country, because when it hits middle class people, then that's when politicians start paying attention.
And believe me, it's hit middle class. Like I told you earlier, yes. We cannot find a house that we can snatch up fast enough. So as far as Columbus is concerned, why did you pick Columbus as a place to kind of highlight? I know you talked to not Move to Prosper anymore. It is now Families Flourish. Right. Why'd you decide to focus on Columbus?
Yes. So part of it was, that you got the worst and the best. And so worst in terms of high levels of economic segregation, high levels of economically exclusionary practices, but also some really positive things going on. And I would point, I was attracted to Move to Prosper, now Families Flourish, because it was clear that Columbus and or people in Columbus were trying to do something really, really positive. And central to my book was interviews with low-wage single mothers who wanted better for their kids and were being stifled because of exclusionary zoning. I talked to a few mothers who wanted a safe neighborhood for their kids to grow up in, were worried about their safety. One mother I spoke with, Kara Cornelius, said she had to drive her kids to her grandmother's house a couple blocks away, because she was worried about safety. Mm. It wasn't safe for her to walk with them. And then, she was thrilled that there was this program, Move to Prosper, Now Families Flourish, which allowed her to move to a middle-class neighborhood where the schools are strong, where she can feel very comfortable having her kids play outside. And that's something that, this is a tiny program that unfortunately, helps a modest number of people. But it pointed to a much bigger mm-hmm. problem in the region, and I thought it was interesting. And you'll appreciate this as a journalist, to kind of tell a before and after story. What was life before they had the opportunity to basically catapult over these exclusionary walls that the suburbs had built, and what was life for them afterwards? And it was a stark difference. And the program is also backed up by a lot of research. So, mm-hmm. so Raj Chetty at Harvard has shown the degree to which neighborhood matters for students and young people. And those children who move before age 13 to a higher opportunity neighborhood have higher wages as adults, do better academically. So the point is, children from low-income families can do amazing things if given the right opportunity. It's just that we build these invisible walls that keep them from flourishing and being all that they can be.
So what do the invisible walls look like? What exactly are these policies that they put in place?
Right. So the most common one is a policy which bans the building of anything other than a single-family home. So in a lot of communities in America, most urban areas, about 75% of the land is set aside for single family homes only. It is unlawful to build even a duplex or a triplex, much less an apartment building. And so that's kind of the quintessential example of exclusionary zoning. But there are more subtle things that are done as well. So in some more affluent communities, they will allow some multifamily housing, small apartments and the like, But then they'll, you know, the localities will require some sort of expensive siding. So they'll require brick rather than something that's cheaper for the siding. And on one level, you can understand they want things to look nice. But it clearly has the effect of excluding people of modest means. And sometimes there's that intent as well that we have to grapple with.
So what is the solution to this? You obviously like the facades and things like that. I know, like, I've covered small cities in my career. You know, people want uniform facades. They want to make a look to their community. What is the solution to those kind of policies?
Well, a lot of communities are recognizing that there are real harms imposed on people of modest means, and that this isn't, it's not good for them. It's not good for people living in exclusive communities either to be live in these little bubbles mm-hmm. where they don't get to learn about people from different walks of life. And so for decades, people, you know, the NIMBY voices, not in my backyard, almost always won.
You mean not in my backyard? yeah, those people.
Yes. But that's changing now. That's changing. And, you know, there's a growing YIMBY movement, and yes, in my backyard. And we're seeing a lot of places that are now legalizing multifamily housing, dropping some of those requirements for, you know, exclusionary siding, parking requirements that drive up the unnecessary parking requirements that drive up the cost of housing. You know, there was one unit in a place in Connecticut where there was an apartment that had a studio, and it required two parking places to be built.
For a studio?
Yes, for a studio. So clearly it was a device uh-huh. used to discourage right. that type of housing. Or if it was going to be built, it was going to be such luxury housing mm-hmm. that it wouldn't accommodate people of modest means. And so that's part of what's going on. There's something called fiscal zoning, where communities will basically say, listen, we're going to do the math. And if there's a new development that's going to come in, we want to make sure that it brings more in taxes. You know, that it's going to be wealthier people who are going to pay more in taxes than they consume in services. Mm. So they especially don't like people with kids. You know, they'll say, oh, well, they're going to use the public schools, and that's going to be expensive to build new school buildings. So we want to make sure it's only,
older people yes. or people with no kids.
Yes, yeah. yes.
That's crazy, because you think diverse communities are better and all that, but some people don't see it that way. It's kind of, what do you think is the benefit for these communities to have people of different economic statuses living together?
Well, I think it's important for everyone, but especially for children, to learn from people through difference. So that can be economic differences, it could be racial differences, it could be religious differences. You know, people of means recognize that part of the attraction of travel is that you're going to learn about a different culture. You're going to go to a place and hear the music. You're going to taste the food, and that we're enriched by that. And yet in our own communities here in the United States, we have the opportunity to learn from others, because this is a nation that brings people together from all corners of the world. And yet too often communities wall themselves off and don't benefit from the incredible strengths that come from the diversity of this country. And so I think that's the main thing that communities, wealthy, homogenous white communities are missing out on, is they're living in a way that makes life much less interesting than it could be. And the kids are going to learn less. There's all sorts of research to suggest that when students bring different life experiences to the classroom, the learning is deeper because some novel ideas are introduced and people think in new ways. And the same is true for adults. I mean, we can all learn at any age, and having a diverse community can economically, racially, culturally can be beneficial to everyone.
Yeah, me and my husband actually talk about this topic quite a bit because of our nerdery and our interest in the world. But since COVID too, from the workplace, people stopped coming in the office. So people live where they work in their homes. And so you have less interaction with other people. Back in the day in Dayton, Ohio, they had, it was more of an automotive sort of community, and funk music arose because, the schools all had money and all this other stuff, but people got to know each other, just not just because of, you know, who you went to church with or who you lived next to, but because you interacted in the office. You think there's a correlation between the two things, like, at all?
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about that angle, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there is research that suggests that the workplace is the most integrated place. I mean, we know churches are segregated. Mm-hmm. We know that neighborhoods are often segregated, but the workplace is among the most integrated institutions in America. Not that we couldn't make more progress, but but they are. And now that people are working more on their own in their own spaces, the importance of making sure that neighborhoods are economically and racially integrated increases, given that we're not having a chance to interact with one another across lines of difference as much in the physical workspace.
That is interesting. I think too that when we do these things, like, you know, box yourself off from other people, it's so much easier to hate on someone you don't interact with to say that person's, you know, poorer than I am, so they must be less than I am.
Absolutely. No, I always thought that, you know, if we'd had schools that were economically, racially, religiously integrated, that you, not to get too political here, but I don't think Donald Trump would have been as successful in running against Mexican immigrants, in running against, you know, for a Muslim ban, if more people knew as friends and neighbors, Muslim Americans or Mexican Americans. And the fact that we're so segregated is not only, you know, it's bad for social mobility, it's bad for the social fabric, it's also bad for democracy.
Sure.
Yeah, because then someone can demonize, you know, it's more easy to demonize people you've never met. And to a certain extent, I'll say this as a, you know, as a liberal Democrat, that I think the fact that liberal Democrats often live in communities where they don't interact with a lot of people who voted for Trump or voted Republican is also not healthy.
Right.
That we can all be learning. And now, you know, there's some interesting research about the degree to which people no longer want their kids to marry across party lines.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I need to look into that. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And crazy and creepy and horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that has to do in part with the fact that we're sorting. We're sorting into different regions of the country, different communities within metropolitan regions that are now more politically identifiable. And that's not healthy because, you know, if my next door neighbor had voted for Donald Trump, I'd probably have a better understanding of what's going on in American politics than I do by the fact that I don't. It's like a lot of Trump folks.
Yeah, it's crazy. We don't interact at all. It's hard to talk to anybody else because you never know when you're going to touch somebody off and they're going to perceive something you say because of what they perceive your political ideology to be, which is, you know, very varying. Like just because you're a liberal Democrat does not mean you believe what I believe as a, you know, whatever I am. Right.
That's right.
So, it's crazy. So where's this whole thing going? I mean, do you see it like any positive things that people are doing out there to sort of reverse this?
Yes. So I started researching.
How about in Columbus? I mean, any positive things in Columbus?
I'll say a couple of things about Columbus. You know, number one, I'm really pleased that the Families Flourish is expanding and starting to get some public support and is able to serve more families. And there's a great need for it because Amy Claiborne, the director there, told me that they recently had 30 spots for families to move to places where they can flourish. And they had 1,100 applicants.
Which is nuts.
So, and that says something. You know, we ought to be investing in communities as well to make sure that people don't feel like they have to move. But at the same time, I'm glad that there is this program and it's a growing program. That's a positive thing. The other positive thing is the efforts of the city of Columbus to revisit its zoning codes. So there's exclusionary zoning even within, you know, the city of Columbus. There's certain neighborhoods where they're homogenous and wealthy, and that's related to zoning policies. And Columbus is, for the first time in 70 years, looking to rewrite the zoning code. So I think that's very positive. I think, you know, more broadly, I hope that some of the suburbs will also engage in this process. Maybe if Columbus gets the ball rolling, then some of the suburbs will as well. And the reason I have a little bit of hope about that is that people are recognizing the harms associated with exclusion. And so we're seeing, for the first time in decades, real reform. Mm-hmm. In, you know, different places like Minneapolis, just yesterday, Alexandria, Virginia, voted to legalize duplexes and triplexes and quads in areas that had been for all single family homes only. So the politics around this are changing. NIMBYs no longer always win.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like the American dream is kind of changing, because you think about, I want the American dream. I want a house with a picket fence or whatever, you know, and I don't know what that dream will be anymore. Is it possible? What do you think it's going to be?
Yeah, I think people are looking for all kinds of housing today, that, and a lot of people prefer walkable neighborhoods where they can go shopping or go to a restaurant right nearby. And that doesn't jibe with the idea that you can only have single family homes.
Right.
And so I think there's young people are seeing things differently, but on a practical level, they just can't afford the single family home in the same way that in previous generations. So I think we will evolve towards more housing abundance, so that people can live, afford to live where they want to.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope you're right. I feel like you might be right, though, because, you know, people who live in these wealthy communities, their kids go off to college, they come back, can't find a place to live. You know, they have to help their kids, or the kids have to live with them longer. There's some studies about, you know, not millennials, but people after millennials, wise, right?
Why? Is this Gen Z?
Gen Z.
Yes, there we go.
Yeah, no, the millennials are the wise. I'm the X. They're the wise. they don't leave home like they used to. They stay at home much longer, and it's a burden. Not a burden, yes, but a different sort of tax on the parents to have to support their young person.
Absolutely. And I talked to a state senator in California who said that in the exclusive communities, that was the most persuasive argument. He said, you know, there's no way your kids can come back home and afford to buy a house. This is an unsustainable situation.
Right.
Even for the privileged.
It really is, because you spend this money on these expensive education, and then you expect them to have these jobs, and they can't because they're paying back these student loans, and the houses are just ridiculous. When back in the heyday or whatever, I don't know, people could afford to have these homes on, you know, much lower salaries.
Yes. Well, and it doesn't have to be that way. I mean,
right.
this is a government manufactured problem. Local governments constrain the supply of housing in an area by putting in these rules that say you can't have multifamily housing. And as a result, the prices are skyrocketing. It's just like, you know, during COVID when there was the car shortage, you know, because there's supply chain issues. And so the prices of used cars went up through the roof. And that sort of thing, you know, It's a basic thing of supply and demand, and especially for Columbus. I mean, this is the only growing city in Ohio, to my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's going to become even more unaffordable if more housing isn't built. And so I think that's what gives me hope that something will be done, is that the current path is just unsustainable.
So thinking of paths, how did you get in this path to do this kind of work?
Well, it was a circuitous path for me. I guess 30 years, I wrote about education and trying to improve educational opportunities for kids. And I kept bumping up against housing policy. So 74% of kids go to a neighborhood public school. So there's some who use private school. There's some who, you know, go to a magnet school or a charter school that's not in their neighborhood. But virtually, you know, 3/4 of American kids go to the schools in the neighborhoods where their parents can afford to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in editing one study back in 2010, which found that when a community, Montgomery County, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., required what they call inclusionary zoning, where you have to set aside a percentage of the new units for low-income and moderate-income families, that the kids who got to go to those schools in wealthier communities did far better than kids who were in units, public housing units, that were in higher poverty areas, even though they spent $2,000 extra in the higher poverty community. So there was something about being in an economically mixed community and going to an economically mixed school that really benefited students. And so I said, okay, I've got to start doing some more research on housing and writing about housing policy, because housing policy is school policy.
It really is, especially in a state like Ohio, where we have, you know, the Ohio Supreme Court ruler, school funding, you know, unconstitutional 7 years ago or something like that. And it's still unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So, and we still pay these ridiculous levies, you know, high prices and property taxes for schools. So
yes.
Crazy. Well, gosh, is there anything else you want to say that I didn't ask you that you think might be important for folks to know?
Well, I guess the only other thing I'd add is that the change can really be bipartisan. I've seen it in communities in California and Oregon and elsewhere, where this is one of those rare issues where liberals and conservatives will see the world in very different ways and yet arrive at the same policy conclusion that we have to reduce exclusionary zoning. So for liberals like me, you know, I'm worried about kind of the civil rights aspect of it, the equal opportunity aspect of exclusionary walls. For a lot of conservatives, they say, listen, this is the government telling me what I can do with my property. This is a property rights issue.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And an economic efficiency argument, you know, the government, basically they say, if you allow more types of housing, it's a form of what they would call deregulation. And so that's something that gives me hope, is that you can find some bipartisan solutions. We don't have a lot of bipartisan cooperation these days, but this is one issue where in Montana and a number of different states, you see Republicans and Democrats coming together.
Yeah, what do you know? Next thing you know, they might be getting married again. Saving. Yeah, having these. But somebody told me they were interracial relationships, or mixed relationships, not interracial relationships. That's something else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate you coming in here and talking to us about this important topic for Columbus.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is fun. Told you Richard had something to say about housing. You can go ahead and check out his book, Excluded, wherever you find your favorite books. The Then What Happened podcast was written and hosted by me, Amelia Robinson, and produced by Patrick Flaherty. The show's artwork is by TL Creates of Columbus. Until next time, see you later, alligators.